Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is August 31st, 2020. I mention this because we have apparently managed to survive August, although Lord knows what's coming over the next couple of months. I do think in the next 2 days, we're going to get a rather fascinating split screen, the kind that really clarifies what we are up against this year. Donald Trump is headed to my home state of Wisconsin. He's going to Kenosha. To pour, I'm sure, the healing balm that only he can do over that that community. Joe Biden travels to Pennsylvania, and they're both going to be addressing the season of chaos. It is an extraordinary moment that I keep wondering whether or not historians are going to be able to capture what it was like to live through this in real time. So I'm looking at the headlines today in the Washington Post and in the New York Times. I mean, here's the headline in the Post. Great patriots. Trump lavishes praise on supporters amid deadly clashes with social justice protesters. You had this caravan of Trump supporters descend on Portland, Oregon, clearly, you know, hoping for or should have expected a confrontation, leaves one man dead, and the president of the United States is cheering all of this on. And a New York Times headline, Trump posts barrage of inflammatory tweets after Portland killing. Now, I understand, you know, part of the instinct is to say, okay, so Trump is posting inflammatory tweets. Tell us something we don't know. We've been here before, right? This is like deja vu. He always posts these kinds of tweets, but this is different because once again, we have this tribal division that is now morphing into something more and more violent. And I think what is extraordinary are the number of people on the right who seem to be, you know, open to this idea that, you know, perhaps we do need more violence. So we're going to talk about that over the next few days, particularly as we see how Donald Trump casts what's happening in Kenosha, the way that he is really relishing this chaos. And if his goal was to change the subject from talking about the coronavirus, which is on track to kill 200,000 Americans, I suppose you could say that he succeeded in some ways, but I'm going to be interested to see over the next 48 hours how this does play out with the president so closely associating himself with not just law and order now, but with, you know, urging on his own supporters to get engaged with this. So and in my newsletter this morning, I do comment on the radically asymmetrical expectations we have of the candidates. You know, over the last week, we've spent this gigantic chorus of people telling Joe Biden what he has to say, that he has to condemn the violence, that he needs a sister soldier moment or a sister soldier month. But interestingly enough, there's no pressure on Donald Trump to speak out against police misconduct or against the vigilantism or against the caravans or the militias. No one thinks that he's going to take the occasion of his visit to Kenosha to do a Nixon goes to China moment and say that, yes, indeed, all Black lives matter and we ought to stand down. We ought not to have gun-toting vigilantes. I condemn all of the violence. Everybody knows he's not going to do that. There's no sense of expectation that that's going to happen. So I do wonder whether or not the narrative shifts again this week. The Republicans have invested a tremendous amount of effort in the rather counterintuitive notion that somehow this is Joe Biden's America. But this week, it really does feel that it is both seriously and literally Donald Trump's America. So we will be talking about that. Hey, by the way, just thanks for all the listeners to this podcast. In the month of August, we've already passed 2 million downloads. We've never done that before. That is our biggest month so far, and we really appreciate it. We're going to do something a little bit different today because there's a fascinating new book out that I have really been dying to talk about. It is The Grifters Club, Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and the Selling of the Presidency. And it is this extraordinary account, and I've been waiting for all of this, about this Palm Beach club that has basically been at the center of Trump Inc., that while the president has talked about draining the swamp, the ultimate swamp is really Mar-a-Lago. And this is written by some award-winning writers for the Miami Herald, Sarah Blasky, Nicholas Nehamas, Caitlin Ostroff, and Jay Weaver. And Sarah and Nicholas join me on the podcast today. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks so much for having us.
Glad to be here.
And again, just a little bit of background on all of the writers who have done this. They all work together as reporters on the Miami Herald. Sarah Blasky is an investigative and data reporter at the Herald. Caitlin Ostroff now works at the Wall Street Journal in London, where she's a markets reporter. Weaver and Nahamas are Pulitzer Prize finalists in 2019 for a series on international gold smuggling. And Nahamas was part of a team that won the 2017 Pulitzer Prize for the Panama Papers. Weaver was part of a team that won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for its coverage of Elian Gonzalez, all for the Herald. So, you kind of had a stacked team here, didn't you?
Yeah, I'm super excited about the colleagues that I got to work with on this. I'm new to the Herald, so it was a really good experience working with Nick and Jay in particular, who have been around the block a couple times, as you said.
Okay, so I want to talk about this book, because I think people are aware of it. I find it refreshing to get away from the Washington-centric approach to Trump, to go back to really kind of the heart of Trump Inc., this Mar-a-Lago estate where all of the rich and the beautiful and the wannabe hangers-on just sort of collect around Donald Trump. But it really is. I mean, how would you describe it, Sarah? I mean, you're the lead author on this book. Is it like just the nexus of the grift? Is it just like the place where people go to associate, to get influence? How do you characterize what Mar-a-Lago has become in this under this president?
Well, I will explain it this way. Every time there's a major scandal in the Trump administration, you can pretty much put in the name of whoever's involved, a top Trump advisor or someone close to the president, and Mar-a-Lago into a Google search bar, and something will come up. So yes, I think the word nexus is the correct word here. This is the place where everyone who wants anything from the current president of the United States goes to curry favor or even just build their own brand. We've seen people who really have no connection to the president build businesses out of this place because of their perceived proximity to the president of the United States.
Okay, so I'm a rich person and I want to suck up to the president, or I want to have access to the president, or I just want to have my picture taken with the president. What does it cost for me to be a member of Mar-a-Lago? How does it actually work? What is the top line on it?
So the entry fee to actually join the club before Trump's election was $100,000. But the president, being a consummate businessman at the end of the day, doubled that price after he won and then has raised it further to $250,000 to
join. Subtle.
And then there's an annual maintenance fee. Yeah, there's no bones are made about, well, I'm president now. This is a commodity in hot demand, so I'm going to raise the price. But you don't just have to buy membership. You can also go as a guest of a member to have dinner, to use the pool. You can buy a ticket to a charity event. So there are a lot of ways for the rich and powerful to get access to the president's home.
So how does it actually work, though? I mean, so what do you get? What do you get for the money? Because you're mentioning you don't actually have to be a member. So when you go, do you have an event at Mar-a-Lago, or you have dinner at Mar-a-Lago? Do you have a reasonable expectation that you're going to see the president of the United States or the other people who have the president's ear?
Yeah, the gamble is this. Any weekend between Thanksgiving and Mother's Day, you have a pretty good chance of seeing the president of the United States at Mar-a-Lago if you get invited. And so that invite can be like what Nick and I have done, which is we went to a gala, we went to a luncheon, walked right in. He wasn't there that weekend, but when we bought our tickets, he could have been, and we made that gamble. Or you have a friend who is a member, and this is actually probably the better way to ensure that you're going to get at least some sort of eye contact with the president. If you can get invited to dinner on a weekend sometime between Thanksgiving and Mother's Day, you are relatively likely to be in a near and close proximity to the president of the United States. And sometimes that'll mean a handshake and a nod. Hey, how you doing? Looking great. Sometimes it means more than that. Sometimes you might get waved over if he recognizes you as, for example, someone that has supported him in the past. Wayne Allen Root was there once. Ooh. Donald Trump invited him over to the dinner table and they had a big chat. So that's That's how to get in. The question of what you get, that's also a toss-up. Some longtime members do appear to have the ear of the president. Other members that are newer that paid that higher ticket price have the appearance of proximity, like I've said, but don't necessarily have the ear in the way other members do. The benefit is more individual, that they can bolster their own brands.
Okay, so how many members are there? It's $250,000 a head. What are we talking about here?
So it's actually capped by the town of Palm Beach at 500 members. That's in the covenant of the club. And so that also raises the value of the club. And, you know, there's something of a black market of influence with people trying to bid to get memberships and get introductions to the right people. It's really a valuable thing to have, a membership in Mar-a-Lago.
So the first few chapters are Kissing the Ring, Better Than Sex, King of the Swamp, The Winter White House, The Man in Charge, It's Just Nukes, Over Hamilton's Dead Body. So what is It's Just Nukes?
It's Just Nukes is an incredible example of how this president conducts business. And this is about the moment when Japanese Prime Minister, Shinzo Abe visited Mar-a-Lago for the first time 3 weeks into the Trump presidency. It's a 2-day informal summit. And on the second night at Mar-a-Lago, there is this moment that we're all familiar with where the news of North Korea shooting a nuclear missile in the direction of Japan comes in while they're at dinner in front of all of the guests. We all knew that. We thought, wow, that is an incredible moment. I can't believe they're talking about this in broad daylight. And then what we discovered when we were reporting on Mar-a-Lago was that, in fact, there was more to the story. President Trump had called the lounge singer over and was showing her off. She's a beautiful woman. She's got a great voice. He's showing her off to Prime Minister Abe. As this news comes in, she sort of gets the gist of what's going on, according to someone who witnessed this exchange. And she says, "Mr. President, I shouldn't be here." And he says, "No, no, it's just nukes. Sing us a song." And to me, it's funny. It's scary. It has all of the things from national security to the sort of dark humor that often happens at Mar-a-Lago. But I think what it ultimately gets at is who the president is. And that's what I think we get out of this book more than anything. This man is an entertainer. He is a maitre d'. He is the ultimate party host. And so when this news comes in, his initial inclination is ignore it and keep the party going. And I think we see that over and over in the decisions that this president makes.
So from the first, the introduction is intruder at the White House. And you write, no president has ever owned a private club during his time in office, much less one that operates in almost total secrecy, despite its semi-official function. Mar-a-Lago's importance to international politics is no secret. It's a perk the president actively markets. And going on a couple of paragraphs, the club has become a cornucopia of delights for a cast of characters who might never get near the real White House in Washington, D.C. Longtime members and far-right activists trying to influence the policy of a nation far from the scrutiny of the White House press corps. This really is an extraordinary story, and it really is unique. And you mentioned Wayne Allen Root, who is actually, speaking of far-right activists, the kind of person that in normal White Houses, you would never like get close to the president, a white nationalist, alt-right type figure. So it really is kind of what a cast of characters down there. If you did a mini series about it, people would think that you were over the top. The producers were over the top and just putting in all of these, you know, from presidents of, you know, the president of China, the prime minister of Japan to, I mean, just the wow characters who are normally fringe characters in American drama, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very Florida story in that sense. And you have to remember the history of Palm Beach. This has been the vacation spot for America's old money elite for decades. It's a mixing ground for Democrats, Republicans, liberals, conservatives. As you said in the introduction, this is really the swamp down here in Palm Beach. And Donald Trump has come in and remade it in his own image and hoovered all these people who traditionally would want nothing to do with him into his orbit. In many ways, you have to understand Palm Beach and Mar-a-Lago to understand his approach to politics.
Okay, so the title of the book is The Grifters Club. So this suggests that it doesn't just look weird. It's not just sort of entertainingly bizarre, that this is the center of actual grift. Give me an example.
Well, I think the best example of sort of what that term means, which is kind of overselling what you have or saying you're going to get something for the price, is this idea that you're going to get access to the White House. When in fact, and raising the price because this club has now become a second White House. This is something that the president has promoted on his Twitter. This is something he routinely mentions while in an official capacity as the president of the United States. He says, come down to Mar-a-Lago, this winter White House. And let's keep in mind that every time anyone goes there, he makes money from that. And so I think this idea of come rub shoulders with the powerful elite, with the politicians, and we're gonna raise the price for your ability to get there is an example of something. And I, also one of the bigger things that comes up in this book is the idea of the domestic emoluments clause. We talk about foreign emoluments a lot. Foreign dignitaries going to Trump DC hotel and spending money there in hoping to curry favor. But actually the domestic emoluments clause seems to apply more to Mar-a-Lago, and that prevents the president from, or it's supposed to prevent the president from profiting beyond his or her salary while being the president of the United States from the federal government or state governments. But what we see when Donald Trump goes to Mar-a-Lago is that the Secret Service, the, other aides and administrators and people from Washington all have to come down as presidential support. And so what it means is there's a lot of U.S. taxpayer dollars going into this club as well. I think this is something the president is aware of. How could he not be? He sees the books.
Okay, you've raised two really, really interesting issues, the domestic emoluments. In terms of the grift, what I think is extraordinary about the Trump era is that how much of this just happens in broad daylight. It's not secret that if you want to curry favor with the president, you enrich him. You write out big checks to the Trump Hotel or to Mar-a-Lago. So what is their defense of this, that the president's not supposed to profit? Is there a fiction? Is there some sort of a pretense that, in fact, when if you want to put money in the president's pocket, you join this club? Or how do they spin that?
So the Justice Department's justification here has been that these are fair market business transactions. There's no added value here. There's no tit for tat. So they're just saying this is the way business is done. This is the way the president has always done business. Nothing has changed. What I think is even more interesting is what his supporters said before the election and continue to say this now. And we heard this from a lot of members, that Trump is so rich that he's not going to be influenced by money. His fortune makes him immune to corruption. And they believe that he will put the best interests of the nations first. And if he happens to make money off it, well, so be it. Who doesn't like money? But they do think that he's doing the right thing first.
The other point, though, is the taxpayers and how taxpayers should react to all of this. Because it's one thing to, rip off some, old rich people down in Florida, and that's, it's wrong. It's outrageous. But the bill for taxpayers, Sarah, talk to me about this, the way in which, the folks in Michigan and Pennsylvania ought to think about this, too.
Right. So, actually, I'm from Wisconsin as well. And what you said about seeing this president through the eyes of people in Kenosha and people he's reaching out to now really hits home for me. And that's what I thought about most when I was writing this book. I thought about, why do people care about this place? And I think one reason that people should care is that it's their money being spent there. Of course, taxpayer money is always spent to protect the president. But in this case, the president's decisions to go to this club, how long he stays at this club, all of those things, what he charges the Secret Service, which is a choice, to be very clear. He owns this property. He could choose not to charge them if he wanted to. He could choose not to charge you the taxpayer if he wanted to. He could give them that room. He doesn't. I think that's something that taxpayers should care about. The other thing to be said is we have no idea how much taxpayer money has been spent at Mar-a-Lago. We don't know that because largely the receipts are still being contested as a public record, that some groups have gotten some of the receipts. And we know that across the Trump organization, U.S. government spending has been almost $1 million. This is only for a couple of weekends and a couple of months during the presidency. Everything else is still unknown. And I think the biggest thing when I was talking with people about this club is national security. All of the emoluments clause aside, all of, as you said, if he's ripping off people in Florida aside, the one thing Democrats and Republicans that I spoke to agreed on was that this club poses a threat to national security because of how insecure it is. It feels like every other week there is a new intruder, a story of a new intruder at this club because it's just so hard to secure. In fact, in its history, when it was donated to the U.S. government by Marjorie Meriwether Post, as a winter White House, this is part of the history people don't always realize. Initially, it was supposed to be this winter White House. It was determined to be too hard to secure and also too expensive, but too hard to secure. And it was given back to the Post Foundation. And after that, Donald Trump bought it. But that should tell you something about national security.
I want to go back to the taxpayer issue, but this issue of national security is fascinating because it's very clear that if you're a foreign power, a foreign interest, and you want to influence Trump, this is a great way to do that. This is a great access point, but also in terms of intelligence. And you mentioned that there were intruders. So there is evidence that people, that foreign interests understand how vulnerable this is, that they are aware of this and potentially are or have exploited it. So what do we know about that?
Well, we've talked to national security experts who said that any adversary of America, even any ally that doesn't have a member or a regular visitor or a staff member on their payroll or talking to their agents is committing espionage malpractice because so many people visit this club over the weekends in the season. If you don't have someone there just taking the temperature, talking to people, seeing what the president is talking about, maybe overhearing something, as we saw with the classified briefing given on the patio during the Abe summit and the North Korea ballistic missile launch. It's just such an easy target. And for instance, this is not an espionage case, but there was one woman, a disgruntled anti-Trump person who snuck onto the property, smeared banana on cars in the parking lot, and actually was able to type an expletive into the club's computer in the bar because no one was there to stop her. So imagine what a trained agent might be able to do. It really is alarming.
So, I mean, the Secret Service, though, Secret Service goes there, right? And so when the president is there, it's as locked down as the White House, right?
You would think, but actually, no. So the Secret Service does go there. They do lock down the perimeter physically. They, you know, have their different checkpoints and their different boundaries, and they use bomb sniffing dogs, and they make sure you don't have anything that you shouldn't have in your purse. But there are some real serious differences. One of those is they're not there when the president isn't there. And as one member told us, sort of offhand, it would be easy enough to bring your gun in on a day that he wasn't there, tape it under a table or something, and you know, then find it again when he was, because they don't have the same sort of, you know, anti-weapons policy when he's not there. That's alarming. The other thing that's alarming is that the Secret Service does not do background checks on people that might even be having dinner at the table, you know, adjacent to the president of the United States.
What?
Yes.
What?
Yes. This is single-handedly the most alarming part of the book to me.
It's stunning to me to hear that sort of thing, given the level of security that we normally provide to the president and given the nature of the world today. So you can, you know, have someone sitting at a table near the president of the United States and the Secret Service does not do a background check on them?
That's correct. If you're a guest of a member and you have a valid ID, then you can get into Mar-a-Lago when the president is there, have dinner anywhere on the terrace near where he's having dinner. And you will not be background checked, because ultimately, at the end of the day, the Secret Service is not vetting who comes in and out of the club because it's a club. There is this fundamental tension between wanting to run a country club that people feel is ritzy and doesn't have all of these extra burdens placed on them. They pay a lot of money, and securing it for the president of the United States. And so how that has played out, again, is that unless you have an appointment with the president, so you're specifically going to have official business with the president, you do not get background checked by Secret Service. You just go, you say, my name's on the list, you show ID to the Secret Service, they bring the dogs around your car and whatnot, and then you're in.
How does the Secret Service feel about this?
Well, one federal law enforcement official who talked to us for this book described it as the wild, wild west down there. It's shocking. And to buttress Sarah's point, Mar-a-Lago staff are the ones who are at the gate. You know, if you don't have a gun or a bomb, they decide if you get in or not. And in addition, the members decide who gets in or not by who they choose to bring as guests. And that's really why the membership is so valuable. You can bring your friends and potentially meet the president of the United States. In addition, there are the charity galas, which bring in hundreds of people every weekend who have no checks at all. And that's where we've seen maybe the most alarming security breach, a case of Yu Jingzhang, which we can talk about later.
Well, and putting on these shows for the members is obviously part of the deal. I assume that your book was already done by the time he actually had a press conference down there, which was staged quite literally for members of the club. They were all there and they got to applaud the president and boo members of the media. I mean, that's one of the perks of Mar-a-Lago. And it's got to be incredibly valuable to some folks.
Yeah, I mean, we see time and again where the president is keeping the press corps out, but, you know, we get news from inside this quote unquote winter White House because members have taken out their cell phones and started taking videos of the president. One of the most recent examples of this is when the president of Brazil, Bolsonaro, came to visit President Trump at Mar-a-Lago. And, you know, everyone else, the press is largely kept out. They're walking through the hallways of this club discussing tariffs and all of this international relations stuff. And it's all captured on video and posted to InstaStory by members and people that are there on the inside. And that's actually how we end up reporting on this presidency so often, is from the postings from unsecured phones of members and guests.
So going back to the issue of taxpayer funding of all this, which is, of course, goes to the question of why we should actually care about this. So when the president goes down, he has a full Secret Service team. He has White House staffers and they all stay there and he charges all of them. Right. I mean, so it never occurred to me before, Sarah, until you said that he has the choice of not charging. Right. He could say, hey, you know, Secret Service are here. We're not going to charge the taxpayers for that. But he charges the taxpayers for the room. Right. For the Secret Service aides and for his staff, I assume.
Yeah, that all goes on the taxpayer bill, to the extent that several staffers ran up $1,000 charge at the bar one night on bourbon and tequila, and that bill got handed in. And in terms of the Secret Service, this is one of my favorite details in the book. To be fair, Trump did cut the Secret Service a break after the Washington Post reported on how much he was charging them for rooms. The Trump Organization made the Secret Service an honorary member of the club, and so lowered their rate to the member rate of $396.15 per night per room.
Well, this is a nice perk for his aides and his guests as well, right? I mean, if you're working on the White House staff and you have to go down to Mar-a-Lago, it's free to you, I assume, if you're there on work. So this is obviously this works for the Trump inner circle as well, doesn't it?
I think for some of the staffers who actually stay there for the international summits, yes. And I say that based on emails that we've read going back and forth. For the Secret Service, it's not so much that the Secret Service stays there or gets to hang out by the pool. That's not how this works. Yeah. They need these rooms, you know, to set up their equipment, to run a command center, an operations center. And so they're actually not staying at the club largely overnight. This is just the rooms necessary to run a security detail, a presidential level security detail. And I just want to point one thing out. So historically, when Secret Service would go to the estate of another president, the president would give them that space that they needed to be there for free. Now, no other president has run a club like President Trump has, but still, the only exception in recent history of a president or vice president not doing this, and I think this is important to mention for fairness, is that Joe Biden did charge the Secret Service over several years for a cabin mm-hmm. at one of his properties when the Secret Service was there protecting him. And so that has happened. That is the one recent example of someone else charging Secret Service. That said, the raw numbers are catastrophically different.
Let's just go through some of the chapters of this book, because this is for people who haven't seen this before. It's this kind of reads like a kind of a funny novel sometimes. If you can just set the outrage aside for a moment, as you point out, this, you know, strange array of charlatans and tycoons who populate the halls. So the chapter, "The Girl Who Others Would Envy." Tell me about that.
So this is really an only in Florida story. And I should say, Sarah read a lot of Carl Hyacin before we wrote this book. And Carl, who's our colleague.
You.
Yes, Carl, I loved the book and blurbed us, which is very kind of him. So "The Girl That Others Would Envy" takes us back to the story for the Herald that we broke that led us into this book. Hmm. It's about a South Florida massage parlor owner, entrepreneur named Lee Cindy Yang, who was the former owner of the spa where Robert Kraft was alleged to have solicited prostitution, which became a huge national story. And I'll tell the story from Sarah's perspective, but Sarah's a really thorough, dedicated reporter. She reviewed not just the history of the current owner of the spa, but the former owner, Cindy Yang, and was going through her social media over the weekend and discovered these photos of her with President Trump.
Of everyone.
Yeah, then Congressman DeSantis, then Governor Scott, Donald Trump Jr., all these Republican celebrities and politicians, Matt Gaetz. And what Sarah discovered and what we discovered is that, you know, Ms. Yang had transformed herself from a massage parlor owner to an access seller. She would give mainly wealthy Chinese business people and tourists the opportunity to come to Mar-a-Lago, go to a charity event, potentially meet the president, or at a political fundraiser, I should say, have their picture taken, and be able to go back to China with a picture of the president or of the club to inflate or embellish their own influence. It's a really valuable commodity over there. And I just want to say quickly that the reason that Mar-a-Lago was so attractive to the Chinese was that President Trump hosted President Xi Jinping of China there. And so all of a sudden, Mar-a-Lago became like Wall Street or the United Nations or the White House or Capitol Hill to Chinese people who wanted to visit the U.S. It was a must-see. And those dollars, again, go into the president's pocket. So he's using the presidency to advertise his club. It is the best free advertising any business could ever hope for.
I remember looking at her social media account and realizing that in Trump world, every misfit toy at some point or another travels through Mar-a-Lago. I mean, everyone is there at some point, you know, Don Bongino or whatever his name is. So you actually tacked on an epilogue to the book, Pandemic at the Disco. Because, of course, this was another one of the stories of the parties that were held down there and the different rules that would apply to the rich and the access buying charlatans down there. So tell me about Pandemic at the Disco.
So it became clear as we were finishing this book that the original epilogue wasn't going to work. This is as the pandemic is spreading and coronavirus is starting to take the lives of Floridians, despite the fact that the president at the time was still saying, oh, this is just going to go away, or there's no big deal, or we've already beat this virus. And so we wrote the epilogue about this one amazing weekend. And this is the weekend that President Bolsonaro comes to Mar-a-Lago. This meeting, this pseudo summit is orchestrated by a member who actually hand delivers a letter from a Bolsonaro confidant to say, hey, we want to have this summit. So you have that backdooring of influence that, you know, it's not vetted through the State Department. It bypasses all of the norms of the way a summit would be set up. The Brazilian delegation comes in. It's the same weekend that Kimberly Guilfoyle, Donald Trump Jr.'s girlfriend, is having a birthday party, and then she's having a high-end fundraiser for the RNC. And what ends up happening is that a member of this delegation has coronavirus. And maybe some other people too. And it starts spreading a little bit. And so basically, within 2 weeks of the president standing in the front of the club saying, oh, no, we're not worried, the club has shuttered. It is not going to reopen in 2020, at least until after Thanksgiving. And so definitely not until after the election. And so we sort of see this screeching halt to everything that's been going on at this club, to all of the intruders that were sort of coming one right after another in December and January. That all ends because the club shuts down. All of these other questions about emoluments kind of get cut off at the knees because this virus comes in. And then you have this incredible moment in Palm Beach. And this is where I think people from Wisconsin, people from the Midwest, differ from the Trump supporters that go to Mar-a-Lago. The people that went to Mar-a-Lago legitimately did not realize at first, at least a lot of them, that coronavirus, that COVID-19 could affect them. They are so used to being insulated by their money that they did not know this was an issue for them and that viruses have no idea what's in your bank account. And of course, that's the real distinction. We can understand why people like him. We can understand why Trump voters feel like he is speaking directly to him. He's incredibly charismatic. But the one big difference between the characters in our book and your average person out here in Wisconsin is that the money that makes it so hard for these members and these people around the president to really understand what it's like for the rest of us.
I don't think you can emphasize that point strongly enough. Over the years, I've had conversations with many of the people who fund major political operations and think tanks, and to say that they have a different view of reality is putting it mildly. So this is interesting that it's still closed. As of right now, Mar-a-Lago is closed.
That's correct. And it would be anyway, because it's really most in use in the winter. That's when the president is there. That's when everyone from the Northeast comes down. No one really wants to be in Florida in the summer. But what will happen when it's supposed to open back up is it depends on the pandemic. It depends on the state of Florida. And I think it depends on some cases and what happens in the election, what the future of Mar-a-Lago will be.
Okay, so I want to ask you something, and this is a little bit speculative on my part, so I'm going to admit this, but there's a lot of discussion about, you know, Donald Trump's ability to attract and to seduce even his critics, why he's been able to attract so many people into his orbit. And one of the things I've always thought that people underestimate is the value of the perks. I think that he understands this at a really visceral level, that just having the access, flying on Air Force One, being invited into the White House, flying with him to Mar-a-Lago, going to one of his clubs, these things are incredibly seductive. It's one thing for people to be attracted to power and being wanting to be in access, because of course that's a very, very strong pull. And it's nothing new about that in modern political history. But Donald Trump has more perks to hand out that really do turn people's heads. And so, and again, this may sound unfair, and I'm not going to name any names, but I watch as various commentators, various you know, actors, you know, in politics who have been very, very critical of Donald Trump turn on a dime. And they don't just go just a little bit, they go all the way. And I just wonder how many of those people, you know, have been dazzled by these perks. And I won't say bought off by these perks, but attracted by these perks, feel comfortable being in this world, because no president has ever had as many ways of lavishing his favor on his followers as Donald Trump.
So thoughts? I think that cuts to the core of what Mar-a-Lago represents and what this entire book represents in a large way. I think you see a president, here's an example, who can basically have nothing in common with some of his supporters. For example, the people that stand on the bridge outside Mar-a-Lago with the We Love Trump signs, you know, welcoming him every time he comes to Palm Beach. There are a lot of them. They're very dedicated, rain or shine. He calls them the bridge people, which I thought might seem insulting to someone who gives up their time to go do that. But he has invited them in. He actually sent a van to go pick them up one day and then gave them a personal tour of the club. And that guaranteed him, and this is only, you know, a dozen people, but that guaranteed him their votes forever.
Forever. Right.
That is my understanding from these people who I've talked to. You know, it's that. It's not the policy. It's not any one particular platform that he puts forward. It doesn't matter as much as being an invited member to the Trump Party. And that's what this is. You see an RNC without a political platform. Well, it was never about the political platform for this president. Watching him at Mar-a-Lago shows you that it's always about the party. And this man is incredible at throwing a party. I want to go to his party. Everyone wants to go to his party. I challenge you to find a single person who could interact with this man, you know, in a vacuum, not politically or whatever, but in a vacuum, and really not want to be there when he gives his toast at the wedding and makes you feel like you're the center of the universe. He is incredible at this. And I think that too many people underestimate that. And that's really what our reporting led us to also.
No, I think that is a very, very important point. And it's a very important insight into the way that he operates. This book is really entertaining. It's really fun. You mentioned Carl Hiaasen, and he actually blurbed the book. He said, the Grifters Club is an illuminating, funny, and often outrageous peek behind the walls of Mar-a-Lago in the time of Trump. The stuffy elite of Palm Beach will merely be mortified, but hardworking taxpayers will be incensed. Carl Hiaasen, thank you so much for joining me. And again, the book is The Grifters Club, Trump, Mar-a-Lago, and the Selling of the Presidency by Sarah Blasky, Nicholas Nahamas, Caitlin Ostroff, and Jay Weaver. Nicholas and Sarah, thank you so much for being so generous with your time today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again. There are now just 63 days until the election.